Here we go.
Welcome to BP Wrigleycast, the show that is struggling to put into words what we just saw. I'm your host, Ryan Davis, joined by Isaac Bennett. And I guess let's just dive right in. Isaac, what are your thoughts on what just happened with the Cubs?
Well, it's never good to host a podcast when you're at a loss for words, right? So, but that's just what it was. I think that it was one of those games where I texted in the Slack chat that we have for Wrigleycast, or I should say I just typed it in, that it felt like the Mets series. Not obviously so much the first two games, but yeah. Games three and four there suddenly felt like we were transported back in time to the NLCS in 2015, and it didn't feel good. It felt like an inferior team getting all the breaks and timely hitting and guys that shouldn't be good, Connor Glassby going 4-for-4. You know, it was one of those things where it just didn't feel real, and I fell asleep I hadn't slept in about 29 hours, so forgive me, but I fell asleep through innings maybe the bottom of the sixth through the bottom of the eighth. And then I went to bed and I was listening on the radio to Pat with my wife asleep. I was listening to the radio with Pat and had it pressed to my ear and was shaking my fist violently when something good would happen. But just a great night overall. And, you know, congratulations to all the Cubs fans out there. And also congratulations to the Giants, who somebody made the point on Twitter that they are not nearly as insufferable as they could be, considering they'd won three of the last five titles. And I fully agree with that. I think that it's a great fan base, a great franchise, and congratulations on another great season. But what a night. What a night.
Yeah, you were spot on for a few innings there towards the end before they rallied in the ninth inning. It was very much a Mets feel to it. There were just well-placed hits by the Giants that were falling in. And there were, I think there was a moment, and this might've been right before you texted it, where somebody hit a line drive right at the second baseman. And then somebody hit a line drive right at an outfielder. Mm-hmm. And this is that Mets series over and over. I mean, that's what happened with the Mets. The picture of that Mets series in my mind is Starlin Castro lining screaming line drives at outfielders. I mean, and I was like, this is how it ends. This is how the season ends. They lose three straight by, hitting hard rockets at everybody when little, even when they finally got a hit, that little blooper that falls in, Dexter Fowler makes that error going to second base, and Hunter Pence picks him off. And Chris Bryant gets screwed out of a hit with a fielder's choice. I mean, yeah, it was just really ugly until that ninth inning. And I remember sitting there watching with my wife in the ninth inning, and Chris Bryant comes up, and I said, just get base runners on. Mm-hmm. You got the meat of the order. All you need is base runners. And I sent a tweet out about this, and I think I noted it in one of the pieces that I wrote recently. Madden went to his bullpen quite heavily in game three, but he didn't overwork anyone except for Mike Montgomery, who he needed to go, several innings. Everyone threw somewhere around 15 to 20 pitches in that game. So everyone was available except Montgomery. Bochy, and I'm not saying he was wrong with this, but in game three, he threw his pitchers multiple innings, guys who had never really done it. Derek Law in that game pitched his career high in pitches, which is 35. And he had never pitched back-to-back games with 30 or more pitches. So when he came in the ninth, that was the first thing I tweeted about was, just keep an eye on this. And he didn't look sharp. He couldn't get the ball where he wanted it to go. And then he gave up the hit to Bryant, and he came out. And it was the same thing for Sergio Romo. I don't think he had gone back-to-back with 30 pitches, or I think he had 28. So it was just, their relievers had been used pretty heavily the day before, and they were shaky as it is. And Bochy, man, that carousel in the ninth inning with his relievers was something to see.
Yeah, and Santiago Casilla was quoted as saying basically he was crying after the game at his locker, and he was devastated that he didn't get in. And he was quoted as saying, essentially, "Hey, I had one bad month, and I've given you 6 years of awesome work and one bad month, and you're not going to bring me in a tight game like that." He was devastated, but I really thought that an under-discussed storyline in this one was that the bullpen for the Cubs, after Justin Grimm came in and couldn't get anybody out, the bullpen was stout. Travis Wood went an inning and two-thirds and allowed one hit, but no other base runner, struck out two. Carl Edwards threw really, really well in his inning. You know, Rondon came in and threw a clean inning, which again is, you know, that's what he's supposed to be, that eighth inning guy that doesn't allow anything. And Chapman obviously shut him down in the ninth. But it's being overlooked because at that point, the game was over. You know, they were down 5-2. Grimm was off the mound. It was in the middle of the fifth inning. And it was like, what are we doing here? You know, this is just falling apart and everything's over. So for the Penn to come out and give 4 2/3 scoreless with only two base runners, I think was really clutch. I know we don't like to use that word, but it was, you know, in a situation where they easily could have just mailed it in and, you know, they'd all worked the night before as well. They didn't. They came out, they threw strikes, they didn't give in or give anybody free passes, and, you know, it worked. So I think there's that. And then in the ninth inning, I was extremely critical of Joe Maddon during this series because I didn't like his usage of defensive replacements. I didn't necessarily like his usage of relief pitchers on many occasions. But he made a brilliant move last night when he pinch hit for Russell with Coughlin, anticipating that Bochy would counter with the lefty Lopez. That was a brilliant move because the second that he countered with Lopez, he knew he had Contreras in his back pocket. So he yanks Coughlin back out and puts Contreras back in there. That was such a seasoned move. I loved that, and I think he kind of made amends for all the things I hadn't liked previously. So Joe Maddon gets a white star on that one with Contreras on the 2-1, two-run knock. Totally loved that move.
It was the most productive appearance from Chris Coughlin this season.
hey, easy on the talk now.
I have to joke. I want to touch on a few things that you just said. And we can kind of bring up game three, too, because we didn't do a quick hit because that game ended at like 2 a.m. And I had to do, for today's knuckleball, I was doing Giants reaction on the series. So I still had to type a piece. And it was, you know, a lot of times to give... anyone who doesn't know or any listeners who aren't familiar, a peek behind the curtain. A lot of times when you're doing game coverage, you're writing those stories out in the middle innings. And, you know, when you have an extra inning game, there's only so much you can pre-do or pre-prepare. So at that point, I had already deleted 500 words in the ninth inning of a story that I was about to fill in gaps and just pound out. And then Chris Bryant had homered. And so when that game ended at 1:45 in the morning, I basically had to sit down and write out, you know, most of my story. And we were all exhausted. So we didn't want to do, you know, we didn't want to stay up and do this, but.
And the game sucked. I mean,
And the game sucked. It was just going to be, you know, a nasty reaction, but. There were a lot of things that Maddon did in that game that I took issue with, and it was mostly the bullpen maneuvering. What I wrote about it was I thought he got too cute, trying to leave Travis Wood in to get the lefty to start the inning when Brandon Belt actually hits left-handers better than he hits right-handers. I want to say Belt had an 888 OPS against lefties this year, so I felt like in that moment, Hector Rondon has expressed that he feels most comfortable, as a lot of relievers do, just coming into his inning. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's done for the most part as a closer. Come in the ninth inning with no one on, shut him down. And then as a setup man, that's kind of what he's done with him. Bring him in the eighth inning, shut him down. So he had to come in with nobody out and a runner on and try and get the next guy out. And he didn't pitch necessarily poorly, but he walked the guy. And so what's Maddon do instead of, you know, if Hector Rondon had let off an inning with a walk in just about any situation this year or last year, Maddon lets him go. I mean, that's his inning. And he's done it. If he lets leadoff guy on, he generally takes care of business. So going to Chapman there, that whole inning I felt like was completely bungled. But he did make up for it with that Coughlin move with Contreras. And at first, when I first saw it, I was like, I don't really like this because he's burning a useful player in a moment just to get the matchup he likes. But then a few seconds later, I was like, but these two runs have to score.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no, I mean, if he leaves Coughlin in to face a lefty, or if he doesn't pinch hit, you know, and take Russell out, who's been brutal at the plate recently. There's no guarantee that you go beyond this half inning. So when I kind of put it in that frame of mind, I was like, okay, yeah, this is the right move. You get those two runs in any way you can, and then you worry about what happens later after that.
Yeah, and I was a little bit on the other end of the spectrum where I sort of wanted to see Russell get a shot at it. And when you pinch hit Coughlin, but for a split second, I was like, what is he doing? And then I thought, oh, Bochy's going to counter, and then he's going to counter back. Immediately, I was like, this is Contreras' spot. And that made a lot of sense why you would pull Russell out for Contreras, who's been very solid the last, you know, for a couple of weeks, really, he's been solid. So I just thought that was perfectly executed by Madden. I love that. I really thought in the ninth inning that the Giants relievers got exposed. You know, we'd been waiting for their bullpen to implode sort of all series. And then if you look at this play log and look at the pitches that they threw to these guys, virtually every one of them was right down the middle. Bryant's was a fastball right down the middle. Rizzo actually didn't see a strike his entire at bat. That count went 3-2, but the first strike was about 3 inches low, and the second strike that he swung at was even lower. So he saw six straight balls. That wasn't good. You know, and then you've got Ben Zobrist. Ben Zobrist came up, and he hit a double, and the double that he hit was right down the middle. I mean, a terrible pitch. The only one that wasn't really right down the middle, because Contreras' was as well, was Javi Baez's single.
And it was a little bit low. It was a pitch that I've seen him swing over many times.
Yep.
And when I saw him start to move his bat, I thought, well, this is like a sinking fastball. I mean, he's gonna swing over the top of this. And he hit it, and he just lined it straight up the middle. I mean, there was, let's not be too crazy about the Cubs in that inning. There was a lot of BABIP. The BABIP gods were with them. I mean, those balls up the middle were perfectly placed. A split second on something or a quick dive on a fastball, and all of a sudden those are ground balls to the shortstop. But they put them just straight up the middle, right through the second baseman and the shortstop. I mean, this game, the way it ended, was things of legend. I mean, not just Cubs history, but I'm probably bungling the stat, but didn't they say last night that this is the first team ever to score four runs in the ninth inning to win a playoff game?
I think that's right. Just on your comment about the BABIP gods, I don't know about you, but I think there was plenty of praying to those BABIP gods by the Cubs fan base. So maybe they heard us last night.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess looking forward, I think we've gone at game four enough. We got to watch the Cubs celebrate in a way that we've become somewhat used to in the last 2 years. So tomorrow is game five between the Nationals and the Dodgers. And I wanted to lay this out because I was laying in bed after I finally went to bed last night, and I was trying to envision pitching rotations, and the Cubs can continue the way they had before, Lester, Hendricks, Arrieta, Lackey. And I was trying to think, if the Nationals win tomorrow, their playoff rotation likely would need to be Tanner Roark, Gio Gonzalez, Max Scherzer, and then Joe Ross. And then Scherzer wouldn't be able to come back until game six, and wouldn't be able to pitch in relief in game seven. So if you get the Nationals, you're getting, you know, if you could close it out in five games, only one game of Scherzer. And you're finding a way to really neutralize their best starting pitcher. And unless they're bringing back Strasburg, which I think would be a huge mistake, in which case he could mix in one of those games. But your thoughts. What are you thinking about the most ideal matchup for the Cubs?
Well, I thought for a long time that I would rather play the Nationals rather than the Dodgers, which I think is pretty much the popular opinion. But the way this has played out, I feel that way even more, because like you said, Scherzer's going tonight and he's going to be burned. So he's going to be burned until probably at least game three. The other thing I love about this, the way it came, we all obviously wanted the sweep against the Giants, but I think it actually works out even better for the Cubs that they played one extra day. It wouldn't have worked out well had they gone to a game five and burned Lester, But the fact that they could actually get John Lackey a start last night and keep him sort of on a normal rotation, I think works out perfectly. So they don't have to circle back and start back with Leicester had they swept. And instead, they can go back and just reset exactly how they want, which we assume will be Lester, Hendricks, Arrieta, Lackey again. The Dodgers rotation, after throwing Kershaw on short rest last night, which was a terrible idea. I definitely thought he should have pitched in Game 5, and they should have pitched Urias last night. Either way, the Cubs have a huge leg up in this series. This is quite opposite of last year when they were walking into just the gauntlet of Syndergaard, Harvey, Steven Matz, Jacob deGrom. So I feel pretty good. I still think the Nationals are a better matchup for the Cubs, but either way, I think the Cubs are a fairly significant favorite.
Yeah, to look at it from the Dodgers' point of view, I think Kershaw could go game two on regular rest, and then if need be, he could be back on 3 days rest in game five, or otherwise game six. Mm-hmm. So if the Dodgers really wanted to push it, if they were trailing in the series, let's say, 3-1, or if it was 2-2 and they really wanted to get the edge, they could bring Kershaw back on 3 days rest, which he's been fairly good at in his career. And pitch him game five, and then possibly a relief appearance in game seven if need be. So
yeah,
you're probably only seeing Kershaw twice in that series, which is huge unless they're really pushing him.
And I think your point which the Nationals' their pitching depth isn't nearly as good as the Dodgers, right? That's your overarching, is that they're without Strasburg, their 2-4 is much less intimidating than the Dodgers. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Right. I mean, it, look at it this way, Lester versus Roark, that's a huge advantage for the Cubs, in my opinion.
Yeah.
In game two, and these are both at Wrigley Field, it's Lester versus Roark, and then Hendricks versus Gio Gonzalez. And that's both advantage Cubs. Game three, you're talking Arrieta, who has ace potential every single time out, versus Scherzer. And then game four, you're at Joe Ross, who is a decent pitcher, but he's nothing special, against John Lackey, who's already had kind of one clunker in the postseason this year, in game four versus the Giants. So, I mean, Lackey could go out and eat everybody alive. So, I mean, that's... just pitch from a pitching standpoint, the Nationals would be the ideal matchup, I think.
Hey, can I circle back to game four for a second and ask your opinion on something?
Sure.
Actually, my father-in-law was texting me last night, and he's a completely brilliant guy. Not a Cubs fan. He's a Cardinals fan, actually, but he was texting me, and he told me early...
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah, right. Definitely. But he told me early in the game, he said, when Ross hit the home run, he said, Giants just lost. He said, Lackey will only get stronger, Cubs will score more, et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually, I said something to the effect of, hope you're right, Moore's looking strong. And he said, you'll score at least six tonight, followed up by comparing Buster Posey to Napoleon Dynamite. So it was a good take from him. But... he said, you'll score at least six tonight. And at the end, the Cubs won 6-5 in the most improbable fashion in the world. So I just found the whole conversation funny. But his comment this morning was that, why wouldn't you run Moore back out there? Even after 120 pitches, why wouldn't you run him back out there for one more? He looked so strong. Do you agree or disagree with Matt Moore coming in the ninth for at least one or two batters, depending on how he looked?
I disagree with him going back out initially, but I'm running it through in my head. I don't know. That's pretty tough. He was very strong, but I want to say in the eighth inning, what he had walked Fowler and then given up that essentially base hit to Bryant and was going to have two on with nobody out until Fowler makes the blunder going to second. So... I would not have run him back out with 120 pitches, because if Chris Bryant gets that hit, or takes a long at bat, you build him up to 130 pitches. I just don't see, you're putting your bullpen in a bad situation if he walks the first batter or gives up a hit. So, if I'm the manager, if I'm Bruce Bochy, I probably would have played it the same and I know I would have played it the same if I were Bochy. I would have gone to the reliever that I trusted the most, and then I would have gone to, you know, I would have done it the same way. I would have gone, you know, if Derek Law is who I trust the most, that's who I would have gone with. And after him, after he gave up a base runner, I would have gone with the next guy that I trust the most. I may not have, you know, I may not have waited on Will Smith so long, and I may not have, you know, done the carousel of bullpen where I did five pitching changes in the ninth inning, but I definitely would not have run Matt Moore back out there with 120 pitches. What's your thought on it?
I agree with that. I mean, 120 is a lot. However, the other side of that is, well, you know where I stand on starting pitchers going too deep into games. But as I'm sitting there and going to bed, as that ninth inning came and I knew the Giants were going to their pen, that was the only thing that gave me a modicum of hope, was that Matt Moore wasn't in the game because his stuff was so good. And, you know, coming out, I thought, well, I had the one little thought, which is, you're starting with Bryant. Doesn't get much better than that. So with the Giants pen, this is the only measure of hope that I have whatsoever. So I had that thought. And then, so when my father-in-law said that this morning, I thought, man, maybe he's right. Maybe you run him out there for one or two more hitters and just see what happens. But I think I'm with you. It was just an interesting measure of hope, knowing that that pen was due for an implosion, and implode they did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, man, and what was the only out that they got before the Cubs took the lead? It was the Hayward bunt that was right at the pitcher, and then they couldn't even turn the double play. How huge is that, by the way? I mean, I think we'll feel like that gets overlooked in this whole thing, but if they turn that double play, that game goes to extra innings.
Yeah.
And who knows what happens there? We saw what happened last night, and Madden had used much of his bullpen at that point and did not have Mike Montgomery. So at this point, we're talking Kyle Hendricks getting warm in the bullpen. So yeah, that game completely changes when, you know, Brandon Crawford throws the ball past Brandon Belt.
Well, and that, you know, their only other run besides the Ross home run was on another spiked throw. I tweeted that last night. Why was Crawford just spiking throws into the ground? It was crazy. I have no idea what was happening, but, huge, absolutely huge play. What did you think of the bunt in that situation? Did you, were you behind? I mean, it was Hayward. Yeah. But were you behind bunting there?
I was, just because you've got a runner on first and no outs, and you really need that run, and you've got Hayward at the plate. And I'm not just talking about how he had been bad in the series or bad during the season. Break it down. Who is the last player, based on what their tendency with balls in play, who is the last player you want with a runner on first and nobody out in a tie game in the ninth inning of the playoffs?
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that.
You're looking at either, best case scenario, he's popping it up to the shortstop. I mean, and I'm not saying that in a snarky way. I'm saying if he makes an out, I mean, it's possible he gets a hit as well or takes a walk, but if he's making an out, best case scenario, he's popping it up. Thirdly, this guy is about to ground a ball to the second baseman. So I feel like bunting was the right decision there. Did he do a good job with it? No, he bunted it directly at the pitcher, which was, you know, a perfect double play ball. And, you know, Brandon Crawford just threw it away. I mean, there was no excuse. The one thing that had me nervous, and I don't believe it would have turned out with anything, but the one thing that had me nervous was I thought Bochy was going to challenge the play at second base and say that Contreras interfered. I don't think he did, but I was really nervous that they were going to go do that.
Yeah, and I was listening on the radio, like I said, so it was a little hard to tell, but the way Pat Hughes called it is that Bochy came out to talk about a double switch, but that was in the back of my mind as well, because I think Ron said, well, they might challenge at second, and I'm shaking in the sheets. You know, I'm like, no. But yeah, it sounded like it. Was there anything in that play that you thought was overturnable? Or
no, not overturnable. I mean, he went into second directly. The only thing that I could think is he had his hands up in the air. From where he was and where his hands were versus where Brandon Crawford's throw was, I mean, his hands were probably a good 6 to 8 inches below you know, where Ram and Crawford's arms were. So I couldn't see any way that it could be overturned, but I just don't trust Major League Baseball with that, I guess. So
yeah,
I just don't trust their definition of that play being what everyone else's definition is, or, you know, I guess I'm not conveying that properly, but I just didn't feel good about that, you know, 100% going to the Cubs, despite how I felt about it.
No, I think you're saying it perfectly, really. And that I think the basis of all of this opinion is that we've all watched too much NFL. It's just,
yeah,
like, anything what can happen on replay, right? I mean, yeah, what is going to happen here? Because nothing that we see seems to actually tell us anything. So, nope, that's all good. I'm incredibly excited for the NLCS. I'll get to watch the majority of it. I'll be in town, so that's good. And I don't know. I'm going to enjoy the ride, buddy.
I'll be in Chicago actually for the first two games of the NLCS. I've got a friend of mine who I've been really good friends with for pretty much the majority of my adult life and in high school. And he's lived in Chicago since he left home and went to DePaul. He stayed in Chicago for, I guess, the last 12 years, and he's moving out to Washington D.C. in about a month. So I'm going to come up, spend some time with him. We're going to probably maybe watch the game at his place, because I think I have some assignments that I'll be doing, but I will probably be roaming around in Wrigleyville and possibly meeting up with other people. So I'll be up in Chicago for the first two games, which I think will be a pretty cool experience.
Definitely. So I assume that your friend is moving to DC to be on Trump's transition team, and that's why you're friends with him? Is his
No, it's even worse than that. He works for the Federal Reserve.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
But I love him anyway.
Yeah. You know, we all have our issues.
Yeah. Yeah, we all have that one guy where it's like he's an asshole, but he's my asshole.
That's you for me, actually.
Yeah, perfect.
All right. And let's wrap this up. So, see you after game one, right?
Well, I won't be on. You guys roll it out, and I'll be listening the next day. And I'm sure you and probably Carlos and probably Joel and whoever special guest we may have can definitely handle game one and game two reaction.
Sounds good, buddy. Have fun in Chicago.
All right. Everybody enjoy the NLCS. Just live it up. Enjoy it. We may be experiencing something that has not happened in our lifetimes and may never happen again. So enjoy it.
Take care.